Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that keeps its Prosecco ice cold when it's plotting. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hi, Corey.
Now, in this episode, Not Enough Champagne joins the rest of British politics by entering the silly season and how best to embrace the madness than by idly speculating what about Theresa May's leadership position. Justice Secretary David Lidington has blamed too much sun and warm Prosecco for constant media leaks about Tory party leadership. So grab your sun hat, ensure your Prosecco is ice cold and stand ready to kick Boris Johnson in the bollocks. The consensus is that Theresa May is doomed, she is toast. We'll talk quickly about how long we think she's got, and then we'll talk about who we think might succeed her. And as far as we can make out, Steve, there's probably four different scenarios. One of them is that Theresa May is ousted after Tory conference in October. One is that she leaves after the negotiation of Britain's Brexit bill, which a lot of people assume will be quite difficult, and we've talked before in this podcast about that. One is that she's used as a lightning rod. All the playing for Britain's Brexit talks, assuming they go badly, is dumped on her and she leaves in 2019. And the other is that she stays on beyond 2019 and maybe the Tories get a new leader in time for the election. Which of those do you think is most likely? Which do you think is least likely?
I mean, I'll start off with the least likely. I think the least likely outcome really is Theresa May being used as a lightning rod for all of the Brexit talks going wrong. I think that's the least likely because I think the Tories are savvy enough to realise that she's not the only lightning rod. She's not the only person who can be blame can be hoisted on for that. When you look at the potential future leaders that are being bandied about, your likes of Boris Johnson, your David Davis, and those sorts of people, an awful lot of them have got a foot on the Brexit bus in one way or another, and would be able. You could make a very strong case that they would bear some of the responsibility and blame. There would need to be a very specific kind of person coming forward. Maybe it's a Philip Hammond type who is solid, sensible, quote unquote, but wasn't seen as a massive Brexiter. Maybe they can make that kind of case, but I think the Tories would struggle to try and shift all of the blame just onto Theresa May, given, you know, their history on the issue. I think it's, in terms of what's likely, I think it's a split between Theresa May ending up going just after the autumn conference, or maybe during the summer, potentially, or her muddling on for another year or so. I think an awful lot of it is going to depend on how certain aspects of the Brexit negotiations go. Is it likely to be before or just after the conference this in autumn? Not too sure on that. It looks like there are certainly some Conservative MPs who are agitating for that kind of activity, but there's not a lot of support as far as I can see for that. I mean, certainly the polling of Tory party members seems to suggest that Theresa May should stay. They want her to stay for the time being, at least. And I think you're more likely to see the bungling of the Brexit negotiations kick off at some point next year, once we've hopefully moved past the divorce settlement scenario. Until you've done that, I think the screw-ups are going to be relatively minor. You're much more likely, as time goes on, to have more examples of the chlorinated chicken debate that we've had over the past couple of weeks, whereby when we start talking about, oh yeah, well, we can have free trade deals with America, well, suddenly, actually, they want us to sell us chlorinated chicken. You know, there's nothing unhealthy about it. Chlorinated chicken is perfectly fine to eat, but it's animal standards and welfare and all those sorts of things which most British people aren't down with, you know.
Oh, it's more almost the EU. Yeah, as philosophy is you look after the chicken first rather than treat them afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. It's prevention versus bashing it with drugs at the end, which is what the US tend to do.
And that's George Osborne's chicken policy.
Yeah, pretty much. It might have been Stephen Bush who said, look at this debate over the chlorination of the chlorinated chicken, and now imagine what it will be like when the US starts saying we want to be able to sell services on the NHS. But those are the sorts of things which are going to potentially do over the Tories quite spectacularly as those kind of things start coming out and people start actually thinking about the consequences of what these free trade deals actually mean in practice. And I suspect that's when you'll start seeing the Tories getting edgy, and that's when they'll start looking for a scapegoat.
Because the quid pro quo, presumably, will end up being Britain saying, can we have, well, or the US saying, we'll have your financial services, you can come and trade here, but in return, we want NHS, we want tinned chicken. The other thing with trade deals, I think, with places like India and China, is that I think the quid pro quo there will be, well, yes, you can trade here, but in return, we would like to have more free movement and more immigration coming here. And again, that's politically difficult for the Tories from the other side,
exactly.
As well.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to places like India, the best summary I've read of what they'll be asking for was, you want how many visas?
I think I'll try and quickly go through the four different scenarios as well, because if there's one thing we've learned while doing this podcast, Steve, is that we should always make predictions.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They never go wrong.
Apparently George Orwell wrote, I think, that one should always keep a diary because it shows that you can be fallible when you're going back and reading through it, and certainly doing a podcast is quite a good way of finding out as well. I think the least likely one is that she goes on beyond 2019 mm-hmm. to much. I think the impression from, even just for the first couple of weeks of this administration, is that the May administration is the John Major administration on amphetamines.
Yeah.
There is no discipline. Cabinet ministers are openly briefing against each other. Backbenchers are getting very annoyed with this. Tory MPs in marginal seats are getting very, very scared. There's a really good Marie Leconte article on Vice about an insider's guide to Tory infighting, talking about how at the Spectator Party, you've got cabinet ministers openly slagging off Theresa May to journalists when Theresa May is only feet away. She doesn't really have any authority, and I don't see it continuing very, very long. I see your point about how maybe May won't go straight after Brexit negotiations in 2019. What I think could be likely, though, is that she may well resign after those are completed. I think with Theresa May, you get the impression there's a very moralistic streak, like she's in there to do the job, and the job she's set herself to do is to do the Brexit talks. And I can see, especially after the strain of the next 2 years of the Parliament, Theresa May saying, I've done this, I'm going to resign now, I've negotiated it, and that will give a new leader 2 or 3 years for a new election. I think it's interesting that the agreement that the Tories made with the DUP, it was signed by the chief whips of both parties. It wasn't signed by Theresa May. And so there's scope then for a new Prime Minister to come in and leave the Tories until the next election, whenever that is. So maybe, I don't think anyone will go for her in 2019, but I think there is a chance that she will resign and there will be a new leadership contest then. In terms of October, I think one interesting thing in the Marie Leconte article is that David Davis, who you would assume is the most likely challenger, I think he's nearer 70 than 60, and this is his last time to do it. So if he's going to become Prime Minister, then October's probably the time to do it. The problem is, as you say, in terms of the polling, you've got, it does split on party lines. Most Labour members think she should go now. There's one Servation poll that says 78% of Tory members think that, or Tory voters think that Theresa May should stay. I think that the ghost of Michael Heseltine still looms large over any Tory leadership dynamics. No one wants to be the person who actually tries to get rid of the leader. It's possible that they try and get rid of Theresa May in October. I don't think it's likely at the moment, but then a week's a long time in politics, you know, who knows. I think what's most likely is there not to be a challenge. I think if there was going to be a challenge, it would have probably happened by now, because I think what's going to happen is a lot of Tory MPs are going to go back to their constituencies, and they're probably going to find the members don't really want to have a leadership election. I imagine they'll want a plea for unity.
Actually, I don't think there would have. I'm very much of the opinion that if there was going to be a challenge, it wouldn't have happened yet. I think the Conservatives are still reeling as a whole from the result of the election. I don't quite think they've actually worked out exactly what the approach they need to take is yet, and until they actually start having those sorts of conversations, there won't necessarily be the actual infrastructure to foment a challenge in some form, because until you start thinking about these things, you can't see someone as the solution, or you can't have a person who is actually presenting solutions. And that I think at the moment is probably what the biggest thing in Theresa May's favour is, that all of the people who might actually go for it or might stand a chance at going for it don't actually have any answers to any of the questions. David Davis can't actually say this is what Brexit will look like, because he's as stumped on it as everybody else. Boris Johnson can't solve anything because he's Boris Johnson and he's a bit naff.
Yep.
On like 99% of things other than utilising weird words in the middle of a speech. But yeah, so because they don't have that almost intellectual infrastructure behind anybody, and there's nobody there actually talking about what went wrong, at least not publicly, you're not going to see that kind of agitation, but for certain solutions. And it's that sort of agitation which I think would actually increase the likelihood of a challenge this side of the party conference, or indeed just after it.
I think it's more likely that May will resign rather than be pushed out. Apparently this talk that she was thinking about resigning on the day of the election results itself, when she realised how bad it was for the Tories. Apparently she was, one of the reasons she was talked out of it is because if the Prime Minister resigns in that kind of hung parliament scenario, that might have opened the door for Jeremy Corbyn to be invited to form a government.
Yeah.
Which I don't think a lot of Tory MPs are down with particularly.
No, I can't imagine why that might be.
The interesting thing that you talk about the Tory dynamics, I think, is interesting. I think there is a lot of plotting that's going on. It sounds like David Davis's team is doing a bit of plotting. Boris Johnson's team is doing a lot of plotting. Andrea Leadsom sounds like she's doing a little bit of plotting as well.
There's a wonderful quote I came across, which was, I think, briefed anonymously, as these things are to the media. In reality, Andrea's probably had two texts from backbenchers actually saying that she needs to run, and they were both probably from John Redwood on just different mobile phones, which I think sums up her kind of Andrea Leadsom's chances of actually winning the leadership quite succinctly.
After her last performance, in which she basically said that she should be Prime Minister because she has children, I can't really see a repeat. The right of the Tory party will have more credible candidates to unite around, I think. Yeah.
Actually, one of the few actually interesting articles from a kind of political analysis perspective on Guido Fawkes, of all places, where he made the very valid point about what momentum basically did was just get people out there campaigning. And the Tories lacked that. Like, in 2015, they had a Young Conservative kind of campaign bus. They were going round and there was all kinds of things happening. And they were going on the knocking on doors and actually campaigning properly. It was centrally organised and there was a lot of kind of push behind it. That didn't happen in 2017 because that campaign for the youth activists got mired in both controversy and tragedy after the suicide of a Young Conservative member. Essentially, it got to the point where the entire thing was shut down and nobody wanted to run it again for fear that something else like that might happen again. Completely understandable from the Conservatives' perspective, even if it did potentially cost them.
I think there were a couple of other factors in that dynamic as well. I think one of them is that as well as the tragic suicide that you mentioned, the other thing is that campaign also was part of the election expenses scandal, which we've talked about before on the podcast. I think the other thing is, because basically Theresa May decided on a walking holiday that she was going to do it without, she was going to call an election without telling anyone, there was just no attempt, there wasn't time to get the grassroots campaign going. And they probably assumed they didn't need it. They probably just assumed they just needed to win the air war.
But in regards to that, I think that's one of the, from the analysis that has been done, that's one of the probably more accurate things that's been pointed out of where the Tories went wrong. One of, I think, the areas where things have, where the analysis has happened, where I think they are getting things completely wrong, is basically what seems to be leading to the rise of Mogmentum, i.e. the notion that Jacob Rees-Mogg should be the next leader of the Conservative Party. The idea being that if you look at Labour, they're led by Corbyn, a man with very stringent beliefs, even if they may be a bit outside the mainstream. Corbyn is able to inspire young people to get out there and do things, and Jacob Rees-Mogg is the equivalent of that for the Conservatives. It's an interesting notion. I think in many ways, actually, Jacob Rees-Mogg is weirdly one of their better performers. Definitely a charismatic individual in a weird way. I think, to be honest, if the solution to your problem is Jacob Rees-Mogg, you're probably asking the wrong question. It solves a problem which isn't actually a problem for them. Yes, they do need to encourage, get more campaigners out there, but they need to do that by actually appealing to young people. And the problem they've got is that their policy platform, in whatever form it currently is, does not do that. When you look at the reasons behind why young people voted as they did in the 2017 election, i.e. predominantly for Labour, actually, it's not so much to do with Corbyn himself, but the policies themselves. You know, I don't think it really matters who you put up for the Tories at the moment. They're not going to be able to win over the youth because their policies just are not you know, appealing to them.
The podcast next week is about momentum. I think you're right. What I do want to use that to lead into, though, is look at the different factions there are in the Tory party and maybe where they go from here, mm-hmm. both in terms of policy direction and a new leader. So the faction that you're talking about in terms of Jacob Rees-Mogg, Matthew Dancona called the ideologues, they've been quite quiet since the election, probably for tactical reasons, but they are essentially Thatcherites, the proper kind of Ayn Rand, Friedrich Hayek Thatcherites, who, as you say, they think, well, Corbyn shows true socialism can be popular, so why don't we have a go at true conservatism? An interesting point of view, even if it's one, it's one that similarly relies on false consciousness in the British public that somehow they've all wanted to try and implement the road to serfdom, but haven't quite got there yet. Then you've got the explainers.
Sorry, I just can't get over the notion of false consciousness and Hayek in the same concept.
Well, can we say, look, it's Thatcherism is a wide church now. You've got the explainers, who are then the second group. They're the largest group, Dancona reckons, of the Tory MPs. And they basically think the Tory positioning is okay, but they think the election campaign was rubbish. I mean, this is frighteningly similar to the one more heave theory of election of Labour election successes. I think it's more true for the Tories than it is for Labour, because despite the rubbish campaign, the Tories were still the largest party. There were still 800,000 votes ahead of Labour. I think the flip side of that is that the government could well be going down a spiral of unpopularity. If I'm right in that the May administration is the John Major administration on amphetamines, you could see the government tanking in the polls very, very quickly.
Yeah, all we need is just a couple of scandals here and there, and suddenly everything is going to go down the drain very, very quickly. And it's not like, you know, they've got, you know, a number of high-profile ministers in high-profile departments who have a history of those sorts of things. I mean, it's not like Liam Fox, Boris Johnson, they're not leading figures at all.
Exactly. And then, so you've got the ideologues, you've got the explainers. The third group are the adapters, who are probably the most interesting group, and they're the ones trying to find new solutions for conservatism, this kind of policy hole you've talked about. Ruth Davidson, Scottish Tory leader, she's probably one of this group. Oliver Letwin, interestingly, when he was in the Today programme in the weeks after the election, saying that maybe people might have to pay a little bit more tax for a little bit more public services, is one of the adapters, I think, too. And Dancona reckons they've got four major priorities that the Tories need new solutions for, which are housing, the nature of work, the digital revolution, and longevity in the NHS and social care. And I think it's really, really hard to argue with those four areas to focus on. Ironically, it's the kind of thing that Theresa May was trying to address in her manifesto, but just did it in such a rubbish way by only just getting Nick Timothy to think about it rather than getting anyone else to think about it.
And I think therein actually lies the problem, is when you do a comparison between this Conservative government and David Cameron's, and David Cameron in the run-up to becoming Prime Minister, there was a strong, again, going back to this, there was a strong almost intellectual infrastructure behind a lot of what they were doing. You had the creation of think tanks which were backing them. The Centre for Policy Studies was very much involved with those sorts of things. There was lots of kind of actual thought and things happening behind the scenes. There was some thought going on in the background. There were people that were putting policy suggestions out there. And that's not happening at the moment. And perhaps that's just because they're in government and it's very difficult to do that and kind of reinvent yourself whilst you are in government. But unless they do that, they're going to struggle.
But I think it's also, as well as that intellectual basis, they had a political basis as well, that Cameron, especially Osborne, they were very clear about which voters they were going to target. So when they were going through their austerity politics, they knew that they had to make sure that elderly voters would still vote Conservative. So the elderly keep their winter fuel allowance. Under 18s do not keep their EMA. I mean, you can argue about the morality of that and the fairness of that. And it's one of the things that's probably come back to bite the Tories in the backside at this election this time round. But there was a very clear objective of how they were going to get a majority. Mm. And it was fairly successful. What May did was essentially assume they didn't need to do that because Jeremy Corbyn, and instead decided to essentially attack their main base of support and their main voter bloc that had been so successful for the Tories in the past two elections. Which is remarkable. As you say, when there's no, it wasn't really replaced with anything. It's not like they were giving people anything else in return. Shall we then just quickly talk about personalities, in as much as we're about to talk about David Davis?
It's not a phrase you hear very often, personalities and David Davis.
No, I think it's... there's lots of different dynamics which are coming out, I think. You've got the people who are backing David Davis and Boris Johnson. Interestingly, just to go into some of the criminology of it from the Marina Conti article we talked about, apparently the people backing David Davis and being quite vocal among him with Tory MPs are Andrew Mitchell, Ulf Plebgate saga, and Grant Shapps. However, what the anonymous people briefing Marina Conte also said, and of course, take with pinches of salt and what have you, that Andrew Mitchell and Grant Shapps were two of the most loathed people in the Tory party. So that might not be doing so well for David Davis. The team behind Boris, MPs like Jake Berry, they're not being seen as particularly very good either. And you've also got the fact that Boris Johnson is a rubbish foreign secretary. Also, the fact he's out of the country doesn't help as well. Apparently, Boris hasn't really tried to cultivate his standing among Tory backbenchers. He's not really got much of a following along a lot of the Tory party. But also, I mean, you see this in the week we're recording this, there's been quite a major policy announcement of the cabinet saying that they will try and commit to some sort of transition deal to take Britain from 2019, when we're meant to be leaving the EU because that's when Article 50 runs out, to 2022. Now, Boris Johnson was out of the loop on this because at the moment he's abroad somewhere, probably kind of in a tank, I'm guessing.
I think he's in Australia at the moment.
Yes.
He was definitely giving a speech, which I think it was Rob Hutton, the journalist, was tweeting and basically said, when Boris gets to the point, I'll let you know. Apparently the entire point was that if Australia had joined the EU, it wouldn't be making wine now.
Who in their right mind would want him to be Prime Minister right now? As you've indicated before, the fact they're both Brexiters, I think, will mean maybe not much among the Tory members, but I think among Tory MPs, I think there's a massive, massive faction of Tory Remain MPs. Again, to quote the article, they want anybody but someone who wants to leave Europe. And I think they might be end up, you could end up with some sort of stitch up where they try and make sure there's two candidates who are both quite Remainers in those final two that Tory leaders have.
Yeah, which is why I think at the moment, if I was going to put any money on anybody, I'd put it on Philip Hammond. Again, ironic in the context of personalities, but good old spreadsheet Phil. But yeah, and I think Hammond's an interesting one because when you're talking about those different factions in the Conservatives, where do you put him? Like, I'm not sure where you could put him down because in many ways he's Stephen Bush described him as the last Thatcherite standing. Mm. He's the only person that actually wants to deal with the deficit, but is actually pro-Europe as well.
Mm, pro-single market.
Yeah, which, you know, means there's no necessarily a natural constituency for him anywhere in the party. But at the same time, you could easily somehow find him being the last man standing just out of because everybody else is either so awful or nobody else is willing to back another horse properly.
I've always thought that Philip Hammond was the kind of candidate who, in the coalition years, if David Cameron fell under a bus, I would be putting a bit of money on Phil Hammond because he seems like that safe pair of hands. I mean, it's possible, but I think if there's going to be a more Remainer person, I mean, there's two people who I would put money on, I think, from the two different wings of the party. From the Philip Hammond Remainer wing, I would put money on Amber Rudd.
I would have, but not now her majority is so slim.
So I think that might help her for a couple of reasons, because if we assume a big dynamic in these Tory leadership debates is going to be those newer Tory MPs, the ones who became MPs in 2010, 2015 and the last election, probably very disdainful of the old guard, the Theresa Mays and the David Davises, who basically got the Tory party into this mess. And they probably harbour leadership ambitions of their own. If anything, it's probably good to have someone who's in the marginal seat who might go, because it means it gives you a couple more years to make a name for yourself and get noticed. So I can see, actually, as a short-term gap, if you were an ambitious MP elected in 2010, you've got someone, well, they'll be PM for 2 years, maybe three. I can become a cabinet minister, make a bit of a name for myself, and then run when she loses her seat. I can see that being quite attractive. The other thing I think as well is, most prime ministers actually increased their vote in their constituency when they're prime minister. Actually, May was the only one who didn't. I think since, for about 40, 50 years, like, most prime ministers see their personal vote increase. And that might help Rudd as well, maybe. And the other things in favour of Amber Rudd, she's a Remainer. She performed creditably in the debates.
Especially under very trying circumstances, yeah, given the death of her father.
Absolutely. Also, George Osborne is a friend. And
the might of the Evening Standard would be behind her.
The George Osborne politicking machine will have a reason to kind of rise up.
Not that it ever needs an excuse.
No. So I would look at Amber Rudd. The other person I would look at from the opposite wing of the party would be Priti Patel. There were two cabinet ministers who were invited to Rupert Murdoch's wedding. One of them was Michael Gove, and the other one was Priti Patel. Paul Dacre apparently is a fan of Priti Patel as well. Now, I don't think Priti Patel is necessarily as clever as she thinks she is, but she's young, she's female, she's reasonably articulate, she's got the support of the right-wing press, she did like the death penalty. What's not to like?
Liking the death penalty. The death penalty.
Apart from obviously everything she believes.
I mean, I think Priti Patel is what I would almost certainly say that if there's going to be a dark horse from the right wing of the Tory party, that would probably be the person that would come out and, you know, maybe rock the boat a little bit. As you say, she's a reasonably solid media performer. You know, she ticks a lot of boxes, which would actually mean the Conservatives are able to talking about immigration. It's really easy to accuse anybody who's white of being kind of racist or being xenophobic. It's very difficult to do that to somebody of Indian heritage.
Well, and especially in the EU referendum, one of the things that she was saying is that actually it could be a way of encouraging more curry chefs to come to Britain. So yeah. She was one of these people who, as we were talking about earlier, it could be a way of increasing immigration from other countries. So she could almost play for the liberal levers as well.
Yeah.
The beleaguered tribe that they are.
Which may very well be something which could work in her favour. I'd be surprised if Priti Patel got it, but it's not inconceivable. I think if you're talking dark horses, though, I think we probably need to be looking at... This is the thing with the Conservatives. They never really go for the obvious candidate. In fact, I think every time they have done, that's when things have gone wrong. And I think the interesting thing could really be that, as you say, there is this newer generation of 2010 and 2015 MPs, certainly from the 2010 intake, a number of which have some quite good backstories, which could be very good, especially against the likes of Corbyn, in that you have a number of them who are former squaddies in various forms, have been in the armed forces. And certainly the odd ones, some of those have been talked up here and there. Tobias Elwood is probably a good example of that, the MP who, after the attack outside, the terrorist attack outside of the House of Commons, was basically running into the fray to help save the life of the... or tried to try and save the life of the police officer who had been stabbed.
I mean, there's people like Johnny Mercer as well.
Yeah, I think that was the name I was trying to think of. Johnny Mercer.
So, I don't think it were the obvious candidates. There's a couple of dark horses. I do agree with you in that I think the next leader... And again, I think this is more likely the longer that Theresa May stays in post, that the next leader is someone we just don't know yet. I think it will be someone a bit like the Cameron in 2005, where it'll be someone we're not quite sure. It's a little bit of a breath of fresh air. And I mean, that's not surprising in a governing party where, you know, the Tories have been in government for 7 years. A lot of them have been in, if Philip Hammond's been in the cabinet for 7 years, they're going to be very tired. They're going to be quite familiar. And I think it could well be the country we're wanting a fresh face.
And I think it may very well be, I think it's still going to be a dark horse, but it may be that dark horse is somebody that we do already know. Somebody like Nicky Morgan, who manages to get herself elected as the head of the Financial Scrutiny Committee. That's a very prominent and very good position for somebody to go for if they were looking to build their profile in a number of areas. And if the Tories do decide that they want someone who's Remain, but also of sound mind and finance and not as hardline as some of the other candidates, Nicky Morgan actually becomes a potentially interesting choice for them at that point.
I think whoever it is, I don't know if it'll be an obvious person, because this next leadership contest is going to be bloody.
Yeah.
Probably finish off by going back to the Vice article. One of them said it would be the most violent and bloody leadership since Heath left. And I loved a quote from the Tory MP. I'm going to try and edit it for swearing, see if you can spot where the swearing was, listeners. But we've got our tin hats on, our bayonets fixed. We're in the trenches. We're just effectively waiting for the barrage of Gove to stop before they launch ourselves into the mud of the Goving Somme. Just as Theresa May was the only one left standing. I think it could well end up being like the end of Hamlet type scenario, where there are just loads of dead bodies. David Davis is there, Boris Johnson's been knifed, Michael Gove ran and then knifed someone and then fell on his own sword.
And that, dear listeners, is how we end up with disgraced former Defence Secretary Liam Fox as our Prime Minister.
I was going to say... Jacob Rees-Mogg, maybe. The subject of next week's podcast. So, a couple of quick announcements before we start. Not Enough Champagne is diversifying. And we're going to try and do a book club, listeners. So we're going to try and take a few books that maybe are new or maybe we think are worth a re-listen. The first one we're going to do is Chris Mullin's A Very British Coup, which for some reason seems more relevant now than it seemed.
Really.
Who knows why? But we'll be doing that at some point over the next couple of months. If you fancy reading it, buy a copy. Help out Chris Mullin, who's a wonderful person. Or just what, there's a wonderful adaptation on Channel 4, on 4OD with Ray McAnally as Harry Perkins. Really, really worth a watch, even if you can't be bothered to read the book. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne, where we post podcasts, articles, blog posts, other random aspects of trivia, pictures of Peter Bone in silly hats. That's all there. Our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. I'm on Twitter at Paperback Writer.
And I'm on Twitter at Centre Radical.
Happy plotting.
Barrage of guns rather than barrage of guns.
No, it's barrage of guns. It was a different word.
Okay.
Which we're not going to use because we don't have an explicit rating on this podcast.
Okay, I get it now.
Yeah.